Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Residents in one Appalachian town are fighting to clean up the region after discovering the soil contained high levels of toxic chemicals called PCBs. The Environmental Protection Agency has cleaned the soil in Minden several times over the past three decades, but there are signs that toxins are still there.
You can't tell me there's not nothing going on down here with PCBs. I mean, you know, the amount of people that's passed away down here with cancer.
Residents worry about their future and their health, but are also faced with the reality that they can't sell their homes in a place with contaminated soil.
I mean, obviously, if this was one of the richer communities, bigger communities, they would have, you know, already got us out of here.
Last fall, the EPA added the town to the tentative list of sites designated for the National Priorities List, but the partial federal government shutdown has prolonged delays by the regulatory agency, keeping residents in limbo. More to come on this developing story inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. When you drive along the winding main road in Minden, you see small two-bedroom homes pushed up against the hillsides. There isn't a business in sight. Some homes look abandoned. Several have burned to the ground. In some ways, Minden's story is like that of a lot of towns across our region. It's a small, tightly knit community. For years, the town's economy relied on the coal industry. Miles of underground, abandoned mines lie throughout this holler in southern West Virginia. But Minden also has something else beneath its surface, a toxic history it can't seem to get away from. On this show, we're revisiting the stories from this tiny town that originally aired in 2018. In the past few months, residents have learned that the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, is seriously considering Minden's soil and water to be a health and environmental risk in need of cleanup. But now, the EPA's investigation has been delayed even more by the partial government shutdown. So how's the delay affecting residents? We'll hear more on that in the second half of this episode. First, here's a recap of the town's industrial and toxic history. Back in the 1970s and 80s, a company in Minden called Schaefer Equipment rebuilt electrical substations for the coal mines. When the West Virginia Division of Natural Resources inspected the site in 1984, they found that the company had stored several hundred pieces of this machinery underground. And the oil inside the equipment contained a harmful chemical called polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs. At the request of the state DNR, the federal EPA confirmed elevated levels of PCBs in the soil and along a creek running through town. The federal agency placed the former industrial repair site in the Superfund program. In order to qualify for this program, basically the land must be contaminated by hazardous waste and pose a risk to human health or the environment. Since then, the federal government has spent millions removing the PCBs from Minden's soil, involving two cleanup actions and multiple rounds of testing. But some local residents are convinced that the contamination is still underground, harming the health of their community. One of the biggest fears is that environmental contamination is causing a spike in cancer deaths in the community. Roxy Todd's been speaking with residents in Minden to find out why they feel so strongly about the issue.
As I drive through Minden, I see dozens of bright yellow signs in the yards that read, "PCBs kill communities." Outside one white and gray wooden house, there's a giant sign along a chain link fence. This sign says, "PCBs killed my wife. Who's next?" I pull over to talk to the man who lives here. His name is David Miller. He lost his wife last year. She died of lung cancer the day before the 4th of July. While everybody was enjoying cookouts and fireworks, he was preparing funeral arrangements. They were married for 38 years.
Oh, I love her to death. We were teenage sweethearts. She was my soulmate, you know, really.
Miller admits that his wife also smoked cigarettes, but she was a light smoker. He says he isn't entirely convinced that PCB contamination was the cause of her cancer. But lately, with the local community talking so much about the issue, he's been thinking a lot about his wife and wondering if exposure to PCB may have been the reason behind her death. With so many of his neighbors dying of cancer, he's concerned that contamination is harming people.
You can't tell me there's not nothing going on down here with PCBs. I mean, you know, the amount of people that's passed away down here with cancer.
And if someone said to you, thinking these things, why don't you just leave? What do you say to that?
Well, I own my home. And everybody says, you'll just leave. Well, I'm disabled. I live on fixed income. I can't afford rent in an apartment. You couldn't give a house away in Minden right now. Nobody'd want to buy a house down here. We know with all this PCB stuff going on.
This is the story for so many residents in Minden. Most are retired or are approaching retirement. All of the people I spoke to said they own their own homes and they don't have the financial means to leave. Miller says no matter what the EPA or the government officials say, he believes people here are getting sick because of the PCB contamination.
I don't know. That's just my opinion. As my wife I lost. I was married to for 38 years. Yeah, I got an opinion. It might not amount to much, but I got one. You know, said I'm the one sitting here by myself now, so they can think what they want to think.
Again, that was Minden resident David Miller speaking with Roxy Todd. So as we just heard, some people in Minden say they've observed a high rate of cancer among their loved ones and neighbors, although the official cancer registry maintained by the state of West Virginia doesn't back up their claims. As Kara Lofton reports, community members in Minden have been compiling their own unofficial database that may paint a different picture.
In the community of Minden, West Virginia, where about 250 people live today, lifelong resident Annetta Kaufman stands and points to each home along the small two-lane road.
The man that lived there, he died of cancer. And then the little blue house that's there, it's just an old house, little shop now, but that man died of leukemia. The orange house, that there were the Brellahans, both of them died of cancer. And then Tom Brown moved in. He lived in Minden his whole life, but he bought that house and he died of cancer shortly after moving in there. He died.
Kaufman believes that PCB contamination is causing cancer cluster in Minden. Polychlorinated biphenyl, more commonly known as PCB, is a toxic chemical manufactured from the late 1920s to 1970s in hundreds of industrial and commercial applications. A cancer cluster is a high number of cancer cases in a particular population over a brief period of time. But despite Minden being identified by the EPA as a location contaminated by PCBs, cancer clusters are really hard to prove. Sarah Knox is a professor of epidemiology at WVU, specializing in cancer.
Cancer is has multi-factor etiology.
Meaning there are many, many things, including diet, exercise, smoking, obesity, diabetes, genetics, lifestyle, and yes, environmental contaminants that contribute to whether or not a person gets cancer. Many of these factors, including cancer rates, are elevated in the Appalachian region.
And you find cancer health disparities in Appalachia and between Appalachian states and non-Appalachian states, and even within states between Appalachian counties and non-Appalachian counties. So you find cancer clusters by looking for them.
Like the rest of West Virginia, Minden struggles with high levels of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and hypertension, all factors that could contribute to cancer. Fayette County, where Minden is located, also struggles with high unemployment and poverty. While poverty in and of itself isn't a risk factor for cancer, poverty is associated with behaviors that put one at risk for cancer, such as smoking and obesity. Additionally, poverty is associated with being medically underserved or having less access to care, meaning if you are poor and get cancer, you're more likely to die from it. It's tough to know exactly where Minden stands economically. The U.S. Census doesn't have income or poverty information for this particular community. About 20% of the people who live in Fayette County, where Minden is located, are living in poverty, compared to 12.7% nationally, according to the census. Cancer rates in Fayette County are high, but close to the state average of about 469 cases per 100,000 residents, compared to a national incidence of 439. Residents in Minden, though, say their cancer incidence rates are four times that amount. They point to an unofficial list that residents have compiled of cancer deaths. From 1983 to 2004, about 152 people have died from cancer in this tiny community. Because historical population data is lacking in Minden, it's impossible to say whether this translates to an elevated rate of cancer, but it certainly feels that way to residents. Dr. Ayn Amjad's father was an oncologist who served the community of Minden. He died suddenly in 2017, and she talks about his work.
He was seeing a large amount of people who had, yes, cancer coming from Minden, a lot of lymphomas, a blood disorder type cancers, and he thought it has to be related to the environment because it was a small group of people who lived in a small, tiny town that were coming in. And so he was convinced that there was some relationship.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, further research is needed to determine if there are adverse human health effects to low-level environmental exposure to PCBs. But in animal studies, PCB exposure can cause a whole host of issues, including death, body weight loss, cancer, fatty liver, neurotoxicity, and thyroid hormone level alterations. Here's cancer researcher Sarah Knox.
So because there are different physiological processes involved in cancer and different factors that affect these things, you have to really do a strict methodological study over a period of time to try and figure out what differentiates the clusters from the non-clusters and to see whether or not the clusters are just chance, which they can be.
And finding funding to study cancer in Minden is almost impossible. Cancer research funds tend to go to bigger projects with broader impact on more people. Knox says in order to substantiate the Minden community's claim, they would need to find federal research funds. It's way too expensive for the state to take on. And until that happens, if ever, it's just citizens saying, please pay attention. Something abnormal is happening here. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Kara Lofton.
Kara reported on that story as part of Appalachia Health News, a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, with support from WVU Medicine, Charleston Area Medical Center, and Marshall Health. We're going to take a short break. We'll have more about ongoing efforts to clean up the contaminated soil and protect the health of Minden residents right after this. It's just enough time to pull up Inside Appalachia on your smartphone or computer. There you can subscribe to the podcast and get a show delivered every Friday. And that way you can listen on your own time. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
When the Environmental Protection Agency investigated Minden back in the 1980s, they found that a local company, Schaefer Equipment, had illegally dumped equipment and oil onto the ground there. They also stored it in containers on site, some of which leaked. The EPA says it removed most of the contamination from the soil. Later in the show, we'll hear from an EPA official about those and additional cleanup efforts in previous decades. Today, the EPA is back in Minden, doing testing yet again. Their return was prompted by a campaign by local residents who say PCBs in the fluid are harming people in their community. Now we're going to hear from a few more of these residents to find out why their fears linger on after all these years, despite the government's assurances that they're safe. Again, Roxy Todd brings us this story.
It's a whole different community than what I grew up in. It's really sad because it used to be a nice little community to live in, but it's not anymore. It's horrible.
This is Annetta Kaufman, who we heard from in an earlier story. Her mother, who also lived in Minden, died of cancer. That's what prompted Kaufman to hang one of the plastic yellow signs in her front yard that reads, PCBs kill communities.
I know a lot of our older residents don't like the signs. I mean, they know that, you know, it's reality, but it depresses them because they, you know, we've had a lot of our elderly residents say when we asked them about relocation, we went around door to door and asked, you know, people, if we were relocated, would you leave? And a lot of the elderly residents said, I would love to leave, but I've been here for so long, I might as well just die here. And that's how they feel. They're like, all my family died here, I might as well just die too. That's how they feel.
But there's a slightly different story here as I talk with some of the young people who live in Minden. In Kaufman's living room, I meet her nephew, Branson England. He's a smart kid, 12 years old, and he pulls up a video game world he built. They put their dog outside, and you can hear him whining in the background.
My game that I made and about Minden, how I view it, and how most of the kids down here view it.
Branson used a program, like Minecraft, to build a virtual version of his home. On his television, he shows me a bright, sunny landscape with well-kept yards and fancy-looking mansions. This is the world of nearby Oak Hill and Charleston, where the rich people live.
Mainly what this is, okay, so right here, well, you can't really see it, but right here, it's like really big and nice and expensive and, you know, just really a lot of joy and hope is over here. And on the other side of the town, there is really like, it's kind of like blocked off, as you can see over there.
Then he shows me the neighborhood that's modeled after Minden.
And here are coffins of everybody, like, or people that have died and that are alive, because we all live in coffins pretty much.
Barrels of what looks like toxic chemicals line up along the river beside the coffins.
There used to not be this many coffins, but as you can tell, there's been a lot of deaths since I first made this.
Do you ever worry that you're not getting the chance that other kids do to just be a kid?
I have to worry about if I'm going to go to the doctor tomorrow and them tell me I have some kind of disease and they don't know of. I mean, it's just really sad.
Branson also told me that sometimes he does have nightmares about getting cancer or someone in his family being diagnosed. As I sit listening to Branson, I can't help but wonder, is all this worry doing more harm than good? I wanted to bounce this off someone who has experience teaching environmental issues to children, so I called up Dr. Sarah States in Pittsburgh.
I'm the Director of Research and Science Education at Phipps Conservatory and Botanical Gardens.
Phipps Conservatory is located in the Oakland neighborhood of Pittsburgh. It's a giant garden, actually 23 different gardens, sort of like a museum of plants, flowers, and butterflies. You see kids, young, some older. How do you approach introducing them to the joys of nature and then also educating them about some potentially dangerous things in our environment or things that, you know, might be concerning to kids?
So Phipps takes an approach to environmental education that follows that of David Sobel of Antioch University, who talks a lot about, and his work revolves around the developmentally appropriate environmental education. Because kids at different age levels, they have different cognitive abilities and psychological needs. So with young children in particular, we focus by building empathy and caring for nature and what's close to them, be it worms or insects or chipmunks. But as kids grow, they start to explore more. They want to move beyond their homes and their backyards. So there's an opportunity to talk about other environmental issues. And as kids get older than that, you know, ages 12 to 14, that's when they're more able to take on the complexities of environmental issues and can talk more about social action and engagement within their community.
If the issue is right there in their community and it also ties in, you know, it's not just the birds and the fish, but the concerns kind of end up being about their own health and well-being. How would you recommend for teachers or for parents to best approach that for that age group?
Well, that's a real challenge because they have a right to be concerned about their local environment. And it's good that they're aware and interested of environmental issues. But we also have to be careful about how we approach these complex environmental issues because there's a chance that children may be taking on more than they can handle. With children, we have the risk of developing ecophobia if we're asking children to deal prematurely with these issues that are beyond their understanding or control.
And ecophobia how do you define that? Just sort of a fear of the environment, basically?
Just a fear of nature or a fear of environmental issues. Today's world, we have technology that can bring us in close contact with ecosystems and habitats all over the world. And I think there's a lot of power to that. We have access to all this fantastic information. But at the same time, we also risk bringing these global environmental concerns to the forefront before children are ready to handle them. With younger children, we try to have them focus on the hardwood forests of Pennsylvania, before they take on the tropical rainforests of South America, because we want them to enjoy and connect to their own homes, their nature.
What I'm hearing is that actually getting involved in issues that directly affect your local communities, whether it's West Virginia or Appalachia, for young kids, it might be a little bit of an easier way to get, you know, start thinking about the issues around them rather than taking on these global issues like climate change and deforestation and other continents.
Yes, partially. What I would say is we should get kids to be committed and care about their local environments. But also we have to recognize that young children just may not be developmentally ready to deal with environmental pollution or contamination, because these can be scary topics that are threatening their homes. So with younger kids, we just want them to go out and explore and have a fascination for nature without, once they're committed to their environment, they have the opportunity to ask questions as they get older and potentially take action. But we need to recognize that we don't want to put the weight of all this environmental concern on children at too young of an age.
And what about the benefits of including young adults, young people in local issues that affect their local environment?
Well, if they're older and they are able to better understand the complexities within environmental issues, you know, as they start to get older into their teens, I think that young people are incredibly impressive and they can be outspoken, really committed activists. I think we are seeing that with a lot of young people taking on serious national issues today. So I think they can do a lot to change the world. They may see that adults are not taking the actions that are needed, so they can be a really strong voice for change.
That was Sarah States speaking with Roxy Todd. States is the Director of Research and Education at Phipps Conservatory and Botanical Gardens in Pittsburgh. So while it may not be the best idea to introduce younger children to serious environmental issues too early, it can be empowering for teenagers and young adults to engage in a project that's directly connected to their local community's health and environment. That's been the case for three high school students in Fayette County who've devoted the past year to researching Minden's possible PCB contamination and the history of the EPA's involvement in the Schaefer site. Roxy Todd recently met up with the students and their teacher as they collected samples in Minden to test them for contamination. And just a reminder, the Schaefer Equipment Company was in the business of repairing, building, and disposing of various types of transformers from coal companies. In the 1970s and 80s, the company leaked PCB oil into the soil.
Markayla King came up with the idea to study the PCB contamination in Minden as part of a year-long research project. She lives just down the road from where the highest concentration of PCB in this community was first discovered by the EPA in the 1980s.
This affects me too because I live here and it kind of, you know, some of the water may come down my area. I feel like I want to know more about my community. I want to help us out because we've been fighting for a while.
Markayla is an upcoming junior at Oak Hill High School. She's 15 years old and is doing this research project as part of a program called Health Sciences and Technology Academy, or HISTA. It's a mentoring program for high school students intended to increase the number of minority and first-generation students that go on to pursue science and health in college. Markayla is African American, and she says she wants to eventually become a biomedical engineer or an anesthesiologist. Her mentor in the HISTA program is Brandy Cook.
Each year they have to choose a topic to do a year-long research project. It has to be something that's connected to their community, community-based research, and it's student-driven. They do all the research, they do the data collecting.
For this project, Mrs. Cook is helping Markayla and her two classmates collect soil samples at the Schaefer site to test how much PCB contamination may be left in the dirt. We hike through a small forest and tall grass out to the site where the Schaefer Equipment Company once stood.
This is a pretty bold project. I mean, you're getting kind of up close and dirty to maybe some potentially dangerous chemicals. Have you ever had any, I don't know, worries about that?
Yeah, I have, but I'll take that risk. I want to find out more about it.
Markayla says this experience makes her feel empowered. Even though she's lived here her entire life, she didn't know much about the history of the Schaefer Company or the PCB contamination. She's been four-wheeling here for years, and she says she never even realized the EPA had been involved in cleaning up the site. Her classmate, Rose Gayhart, doesn't live in Minden, but she says she thinks it's important for young people to learn about issues like this in their area.
Because, I mean, we're the next generation. If we don't do something, who knows if someone will?
We reach a swampy area where an orange flow of water seeps through the forest. Old rotting leaves clog the top of the small stream. The Schaefer Equipment Company actually stood on top of a former coal mine site. According to one researcher I spoke with at the West Virginia DEP, Minden sits on top of multiple abandoned mine sites, crisscrossing and running beneath the ground for miles. The students tell me their hypothesis, that soil samples here in Minden will test higher in PCB levels compared with soil samples in the nearby community of Oak Hill.
You want to help him? Can we get you some gloves?
Mrs. Cook hands Markayla and her teammates Corey and Rose gloves and the test tubes.
The first part of this test involves collecting an actual soil sample, which is what Corey's getting ready to do. He's got a
Corey bends down in the mud to scoop it into the glass tube.
And then we'll use a series of chemical reactions.
All the sampling and testing is done right here along the creek bed. They'll be able to determine the results in about 20 minutes.
Eventually, after we go through all the steps, we'll be able to compare our results to a chart to see whether it's above or below 50 parts per million of PCB.
They add another chemical to see how it reacts. This is part of a kit their teacher ordered online that tests PCB contamination. Corey shakes the bottle. The color of the mud in the test tube changes to a greenish-brown color. On the instructions, they match the color with the level of PCB, less than 50 parts per million. Probably not high enough for alarm, at least not because of PCB. But the water doesn't look entirely safe either. As I mentioned earlier, there's an eerie orange tint to the water that is most likely due to acid mine drainage from one of the abandoned mines that lies underground here. I see no fish or tadpoles swimming, and there's a noticeable gassy smell bubbling up from the creek bed. This test the students use is not as sophisticated as what the EPA uses, and maybe with a more expensive test, they could get a more exact figure of the level of PCBs in the dirt, or a better idea of what other contaminants may also be in the water. Markayla tells me she's not surprised to learn the PCB isn't very high. After all, this backs up what the EPA has reported in recent findings. But, she says, any contamination at all, no matter how small, is alarming.
I never knew anything about it when I was younger. I'm just now finding out about this, and it's just kind of mind-blowing because I didn't know this stuff has been happening for years.
The hands-on experience getting out into the field and testing the dirt near her home has made her even more convinced that this is the type of work she'd like to study in college and go on to do as an adult. At least, she feels confident that some type of health science is in her future. Maybe something where she can help people, like her neighbors in Minden. Later, when the students compare their test samples with the ones they collect in Oak Hill, they find them to contain similar levels of PCB. However, they later learned that the sample site they chose in Oak Hill was the site of a car crash. The accident may have caused PCB to leak into the soil, so they plan to repeat the experiment again next year. Markayla says she's interested to find out what the EPA reports later this year when they release the results from their tests from Minden to see what levels of PCB they found near her home. At this time, the EPA says most of the samples they collected in Minden in 2017 have contained less than 2 parts per million PCB, far under the levels that would pose serious risk to human health, according to officials. There was one result that came back at 6.2 parts per million and another at 50 parts per million. But they are resampling that area again to find out if there is indeed a high enough risk to justify placing the site on the Superfund National Priorities List. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Minden. The EPA has been involved in cleaning up PCBs from the Minden site at least three times in the past. Most recently, they contracted the United States Army Corps of Engineers to design a cap for the remaining contaminated soil. That cap was completed in 2002. Now the EPA has returned to the site and have been collecting soil samples to determine whether they need to launch a fourth cleanup action. Roxy Todd spoke with one EPA official, Melissa Linden, who's been involved with investigating and researching the Schaefer site for about 2.5 years.
In December of 2016, the residents reached out to West Virginia DEP and EPA, reiterating some concerns they had about previous actions taken and conditions currently at the site. So as we do with all resident concerns is the follow-up. So that's why we went back out with West Virginia DEP to look at the site and determine that we wanted to take some additional samples just to confirm that the cap was still holding the contaminated material in place and secure.
And the cap that you mentioned, what is that?
Sure. So between 2001 and 2003, we put the cap in place. Basically, EPA worked with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to develop a permanent fixture at the site to cover the remaining contaminated soil and the last building to be demolished. In 1997, they had vandals that got onto the property and caused a fire in that building. So then we then came back because material had spilled from that building. So we excavated, placed it all in one location, and constructed the cap over top of it.
So it's underground, cap containing something, I'm trying to picture it in my head.
Sure. So the structure of the cap, contaminated material, is below what we call a geotextile, or basically a fabric layer. And then above that, we put clay. And then above that, we put topsoil. So there's approximately 3 feet of material over the contaminated material.
So what have been the results so far of the testing that the EPA has done last year in 2017 on soil or water? Have there been alarming rates of PCBs, or what have been the results?
Sure. So what we would consider a number for needing immediate action would be 24 parts per million. All of the residential soils that we sampled in December were even below 1 part per million. So they're considerably less than what we would determine needing immediate action.
Okay. And that's kind of, you said residential, so I know there were some houses along the creek that residents were worried about. So it's not exactly on the Schaefer site that these tests were collected, the samples, but just in the areas around the creek bed. Is that right?
So we sampled on the site and for approximately a mile down from the site, adjacent properties to Arbuckle Creek and within Arbuckle Creek sediment.
So nothing alarming. Nobody has to move immediately, obviously, because that's a pretty safe number, it sounds like.
Right. We had, a couple of numbers above 1 part per million in the sediment. So in June, we found a result, or our samples came back with a result of 6.2 part per million and a 50 part per million. So that's why we went back out in December and resampled. And the highest number we got in the December sampling for the sediment was a 1.8 part per million.
And the EPA has been involved with the Schaefer site for a number of decades. Dirt from the Schaefer site was trucked away. Where did that PCB dirt actually end up?
So we removed contaminated soil, and we removed actual drums of PCB-containing oil. So the soil itself was hauled away and disposed of at a landfill in Emile, Alabama. And then the drums, scrap metal from the transformers and capacitors were taken to locations, a CECOS landfill in Ohio and a Rawlings incinerator in New Jersey.
Linden points out that one reason the EPA has had to return to the site several times to do additional cleanups is because it's very difficult to completely dispose of PCBs once they have contaminated the soil.
PCBs don't tend to be very mobile in soil or with water because they don't dissolve into the water. And they tend to stick to organic material, so that makes them stay put in soil, as well as their degradation doesn't occur rapidly to make them more mobile.
Despite these challenges to clean up the site, Linden says that if the cap they've built stays in place, there likely isn't much PCB getting into the water around Minden or contaminating the residents. Later this fall, Linden says the EPA will know whether their results have shown PCB contamination to be harmful enough to human health to place the Schaefer site in Minden on the Superfund National Priorities List. But even if this happens, Linden says it's very uncommon for the EPA to relocate residents near Superfund sites permanently. Sometimes they will temporarily relocate people while a site is being cleaned up. But as we'll hear later in this episode, the cleanup time for some Superfund sites is taking the agency longer and longer. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd.
A regional administrator with the EPA visited Minden in June of 2018 to meet with local residents to hear their concerns. Up next, how could federal cuts to the Superfund budget slow down the EPA's cleanup process for sites with contamination? You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back. Today we've been hearing from residents of Minden, West Virginia, who believe toxic waste is causing high rates of cancer in their community. Some want the Environmental Protection Agency to put their town on the Superfund Program's National Priorities List, or NPL. But what does it mean when a community is placed on the NPL? Do contaminated areas get cleaned up? And what happens to a community's residents in the process? West Virginia Public Broadcasting's energy and environment reporter Brittany Patterson visited one site in north central West Virginia to learn more.
On a recent drive through the Northview neighborhood of Clarksburg, James LaChapelle surveys what is left of the factory that was once the lifeblood of this blue-collar community.
See, if you look down the road, you could see how much of the factory has collapsed. See where the trees are and everything? That's all caved in.
Broken windows dot the dilapidated structure, which was once the Roland Glass factory. Luscious green vines and trees almost obscure the piles of tires and other refuse. LaChapelle has lived here his entire life. His grandfather, father, and brother all worked at the glass factory, which closed its doors in the 1970s.
I grew up with that factory there and never had one worry about it. I mean, we just grew up, okay, that's just the way it was. But as you got older and the factory collapsed, then you started worrying, when are they going to clean this mess up?
2 years ago, the Environmental Protection Agency said it was going to take over cleanup of the site through its Superfund program, after concerns surfaced that a nearby rail trail might be contaminated with lead, zinc, and arsenic from the factories and leaching into the North Fork River. LaChapelle was excited, but at a community meeting hosted by the EPA in 2016, officials outlined a timeline that tapered the 68-year-old's expectations.
EPA, I love you to death. I'm glad you're looking. But 25 years, it's just a mite long.
Even though it may take a long time to clean up this site, Clarksburg's assistant city manager, Anthony Bellotti, says he's hopeful.
In 2016, we became fortunate and we were listed on the national priorities list that identifies us as a most serious site for long-term, being eligible for long-term cleanup.
Bellotti doesn't use the term fortunate lightly. He says if the site had not been added to the Superfund program's national priorities list, the city may have been on the hook to clean up the contamination.
We do feel very fortunate, and this will ultimately end up with some cleanup. And as a result of the cleanup, it all goes towards future economic development.
With the help of another federal cleanup program run by the EPA, the Brownfields Program, Clarksburg has cleaned up a different glass factory, as well as two other contaminated sites. Where the Adamston Glass Factory once stood, today, at the Adamston Commons, residents of Clarksburg can shop at two grocery stores and a Dollar Tree. With the Brownfields Program, EPA provides grants and technical assistance to communities to help them clean up a site. Local or state governments must pitch in a percentage of the cost to qualify. But Superfund is different. The program was created in 1980 when Congress passed the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, or CERCLA. It deals with the most toxic sites in the country. The law tasks EPA with determining how contaminated a site is and then making a plan to clean it up. Sometimes that can mean working with the site's owner or responsible party to do a cleanup. Other times, EPA pays for it themselves. There are more than 2,000 total Superfund sites in the country. More than half are on the national priorities list, which is basically EPA's to-do list when it comes to funding cleanups. Sites on the NPL, as it's often called, take precedence. There are 243 Superfund sites on the NPL across Appalachia. 10, including the one in Clarksburg, are located in West Virginia. Many communities, including Clarksburg and the town of Minden in Fayette County, advocate to be included on the national priorities list, hoping their inclusion will come with significant federal resources. But getting a spot on the NPL does not mean that help will come quickly.
That may take months to years to actually have any action taken on the NPL.
John Hando worked for the West Virginia DEP for 20 years as a hazardous waste inspector, which brought him in close contact with many of the state's Superfund sites. He says West Virginia has a long history of supporting the war efforts associated with World War II and Vietnam. The state also has an early history in manufacturing. Those two elements have contributed to the types of sites listed under Superfund in West Virginia today. He says early on, Superfund was successful in West Virginia.
In the early 80s, well, late 80s, you had across the state of West Virginia lots of sites that the state knew about and, of course, the US EPA knew about. So you had actions taken on the ordnance works here in Morgantown. You had what was called the Leetown Pesticide site out in the eastern panhandle. You had another ordnance works in the southern part of the state. Those were actions that were taken as soon as the EPA could.
Hando says Superfund is a great tool the federal government can use to prompt action from companies that own contaminated sites. It's often the only option for cleanups for sites where the responsible party has gone out of business, no longer exists, or does not have the means to deal with the contamination. But as time has gone on, federal resources have shrunk. Superfund gets its money from two pots, congressional appropriations, and until about two decades ago, a tax on petroleum and chemical industries. Both sources are dwindling. From 1999 through 2013, congressional appropriations to the Superfund program were cut from about $2 billion to about $1.1 billion, according to a 2015 Government Accountability Office report. And in 1995, Congress let a polluter pays tax on petroleum and chemical industries expire. The tax paid for the Superfund and provided resources for EPA to clean up orphan sites, or sites where there is no responsible party. In an interview, EPA Superfund site coordinator Melissa Linden said the agency did not feel declining funding affected its ability to run the program.
I don't see that it would decrease our ability to take action. It would make us rely on prioritizing and potentially doing phased actions, as we have in the past, even on other larger sites.
But former EPA officials tell a different story.
It takes you longer to
do the assessment of what the cleanup is going to require.
Christine Todd Whitman ran the EPA for 3 years under the Bush administration. During her time at the agency, one of her priorities was to push Congress to reauthorize the 1995 tax. She says the lapsed source of funding is affecting nearly every aspect of EPA's ability to pursue new cleanups and advance ones that are already on the NPL. The average time it takes to complete a cleanup under Superfund has lengthened. From 1986 to 1989, projects were finished, on average, about 4 years after a site was placed on the NPL. By 1996, the average time was nearly 11 years, according to the Government Accountability Office. Matthew Stanislaus ran the Superfund program under the Obama administration. He says less resources for Superfund ultimately harms the communities that live near them.
Every dollar taken away from that program means compromising public health, increasing the risk of disease, as well as delaying economic recovery and job recovery for communities that need it the most.
Studies show communities that live near Superfund sites often find the value of their home decreases. Even after a cleanup, it's less likely property values will rebound. The current head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, has said removing sites from Superfund is a priority for the administration. The agency says it is doing that by enlisting the help of a task force and holding more responsible parties accountable. But in its first budget request to Congress, the White House proposed slashing Superfund's budget by about 25%. Congress ultimately rejected the cuts. Whitman, who ran the EPA during the George W. Bush administration, says that tactic makes no sense.
Scott Pruitt was comfortable with the budget as it was submitted, with severe cuts to Superfund and cutting the agency overall. You can't protect human health and the environment, and that's all the agency's about.
Whitman says she doesn't think the challenges with the Superfund program should be seen as a political issue. Ultimately, those who are hurt most are the people who live near contaminated sites. The EPA estimates approximately 53 million people live within 3 miles of a Superfund site, approximately 16% of the U.S. population. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brittany Patterson.
That story originally aired last year. Scott Pruitt's no longer the head of the EPA. Andrew Wheeler, who was the deputy administrator of EPA under Pruitt, is now serving as the acting administrator. President Donald Trump has nominated him to lead the agency. Wondering if you live near a Superfund site? On our website, we've posted a map of Superfund sites that are located on the national priorities list throughout Appalachia. Find it at wvpublic.org. The National Priorities List, or NPL, is a list of the most toxic, contaminated sites in the country. Qualifying for the NPL means the federal government will pay for yet another cleanup. 2 years ago, residents asked the EPA to do more testing, and last September, residents got some news. After analyzing new data, the agency proposed listing Minden on the Superfund National Priorities List. As residents have long feared, the new testing revealed that PCBs have traveled downstream in Arbuckle Creek, the meandering channel that runs through town and eventually to the New River, a drinking water source for thousands in nearby Oak Hill. But for some here, like Susie Worley Jenkins, the Superfund NPL designation isn't enough. They want financial assistance to relocate, and they want the EPA to do even more in-depth testing. The latest rounds of soil sampling largely only went 6 inches deep. Advocates say the pollution likely goes deeper, so that means cleanup would need to as well. And there's concern that the PCB-laced water will continue to gush out of the area's abandoned mines, whose cleanup falls on the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection. Worley Jenkins has lived in Minden her entire life. She's also a community organizer who has for years tried to get help cleaning up more than 2 decades of toxic PCB contamination.
It's already been right at 2 years, and these folks are no closer to getting out of here than they were then.
Worley Jenkins wants the West Virginia DEP to be more proactive in monitoring and limiting discharges from the 8 abandoned mines under Minden. We reached out to the DEP, and a spokesperson for the agency didn't allow us to speak with someone about the remediation plans for the mines near Minden. So if the EPA can't or won't relocate residents who are still there, Worley Jenkins wants Governor Justice and the state legislature to appropriate the money to do it.
This has got to stop. They're killing everybody by doing that. They need to test this water. They need to find another source of water, because giving us PCB water and water that has pesticides and iron and everything into it and not testing it properly, yeah, I think there's a lot the state could do. I know that the state is the poorest state there is. I realize that. But they are their worst enemy as far as the state goes. If they stop letting people dump on us, clean this place up, this place is beautiful. You know, there's so much resource here. It's just unreal. But if they allow fracking, PCBs, sewage, and let this place become nasty, and it's all about the dollar, you know, no, they got to stop and clean it up. It's not going to last forever.
Minden isn't the only community struggling for this type of validation. People who live on the ground in environmentally compromised communities sometimes have a very different experience than what the data would suggest. And as a matter of fact, people up north who live along the Hudson River in New York are also dealing with their own struggle to clean up PCBs. For our final story, we're going to step beyond Appalachia's borders for a story about a big fight in upstate New York over the future of the Hudson River. General Electric spent 6 years and hundreds of millions of dollars trying to dredge toxic PCBs from New York's Hudson River. But now it's not clear whether this massive cleanup actually worked. Over the last decade, the federal government forced General Electric to spend hundreds of millions of dollars cleaning up tons of toxic PCBs, oily toxic chemicals the company dumped in the river. It was seen as a model program, but as North Country Public Radio Brian Mann reports, a growing number of critics say it didn't work.
It's a bitter cold day in Hudson Falls, New York, and I'm down by the icy riverbank. This is a stretch of water the state of New York says is still dangerously polluted. Basil Sagos heads New York's Department of Environmental Conservation.
The levels of contamination in both fish and sediment have remained troublingly high.
His office released a big new study last month concluding that levels of toxic PCBs haven't declined much despite 6 years of dredging and other restoration work.
That doesn't mean that the original dredging was not worth it. But then you have to assess whether or not it worked and whether more is needed.
General Electric hauled out tons of contaminated muck, spending roughly $2 billion on one of the biggest environmental cleanup efforts the U.S. has ever seen. This Superfund site sprawls over more than 200 miles of the Hudson River. The Environmental Protection Agency is doing its own research, trying to decide whether that work was good enough that they can call the project complete. But Manajo Green, an environmental activist, says the report by scientists working for New York State shows that a clean bill of health for the Hudson would be premature.
The results are disappointing, and that a more robust cleanup is needed. EPA must not issue a certificate of completion to General Electric because that would let them off the hook.
But there's growing skepticism in these old industrial towns along the upper Hudson that more dredging and more cleanup will do any good.
They should have left it alone from the get-go.
Jay Harrington lives right next to the river. The backyard where his dogs play is bordered by the contaminated riverbank.
I mean, you live near the water. You say you've boated on it all these years. Do you worry about the health effects on you?
Too late now.
You hear this over and over here, a kind of resignation. GE spread PCBs all over this valley before people realized the industrial chemical causes deformities in fish and other wildlife and carries a risk of cancer for humans. In a coffee shop nearby, Art and William Wells are eating lunch.
How are you going to get it all out of the water? I just don't see how.
I'm thinking with him. Waste of time. I live right behind GE. I'm glowing. Can't you see me?
General Electric, meanwhile, is lobbying the EPA hard, hoping to convince federal officials that enough progress has been made, that more dredging isn't needed. By some estimates, another round of cleanup could cost GE $500 million at a time when the corporation is struggling financially. GE spokesman Mark Behan says the cleanup did more good than critics are willing to admit, and he accuses New York State of moving the goalposts, setting new, stricter standards to measure the cleanup success.
Based on the new standard it's applying, New York State now says they don't meet the threshold, but they did meet the EPA threshold.
Basil Sagos, New York's conservation commissioner, says that's just not true.
Our research in the last 2 years followed the exact same protocols as the EPA-mandated protocols that GE followed. So to suggest otherwise is frankly absurd.
EPA officials who weren't available to talk because of the partial government shutdown will play referee here, deciding what additional work, if any, has to be done. Their final answer is expected this year, and whichever way they rule, it'll likely be tested by a lawsuit. This debate and the science emerging from the Hudson cleanup are being watched closely. Around the country, officials are preparing other big dredging projects on rivers contaminated with PCBs.
That was North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reporting from Hudson Falls, New York. That story originally aired on NPR's All Things Considered earlier this month. On this show, we heard from residents in both New York and West Virginia looking for better solutions for industrial cleanup. In Minden, West Virginia, residents are growing impatient with the government's solution so far. After decades of numerous cleanup efforts, the dirt continues to show signs of contamination, points out Michaela King. She's the Oak Hill High School junior you heard from earlier in the show.
Minden is going to be put on the NPL list because, you know, the problem they see, but they're only going to do a cleanup. But they've seen that this cleanup has not worked for the past years. So it doesn't really make sense to do another cleanup and not going to get them anywhere. That's just, you know, doing the same thing and not getting any results from it. So, you know, there's no point in doing that except, you know, trying to relocate the people living here.
We've heard a lot about government accountability lately and how our taxpayer dollars have been or will be wasted. Finding ways to measure the success of a program can be tough, especially in government, with politics involved. But just as a teenager explained in this show, traditional methods haven't always worked. And when you know it hasn't worked, we have to find a way to move forward for the people and not for political gains. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Brittany Patterson and Kara Lofton. Music in today's show was provided by Spencer Elliott, Larry Gross, Dinosaur Burps, and Michael Howard. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Catherine Moore edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org or address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you could subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.